Welcome, everyone. My name is Scott Shepherd, founder and CEO, host of the City's First podcast, as well as the City's First Advisors. Super excited to partner with one of our longstanding media partners, Autonomy, and founder and CEO, Ross Douglas, who's been leading the efforts at Autonomy for many years now, based out of Paris. Hey, Ross, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us here.
Hey Scott, nice to be with you. Thank you.
Yes, no, this is great stuff. We're really excited to kind of talk about the transformation of Autonomy into the carbon decarbonization expo event, as well as some of the latest initiatives that you've been working on in this sector, kind of as mobility has been transforming and changing kind of in this post-COVID landscape. So with that, we're just going to get started. I think everyone that follows the City's First podcast knows our format and formula. So we're just going to go through your bio. We're going to go through about five or six questions, all about 30, 40 minutes. And then we'll just hear from you in terms of your view for the future and where we can find you on social media. So with that, we're just going to kind of run through a little bit more of an abbreviated bio than it's very impressive. So we'll try to get this down really quickly here. So Ross Douglas is a South African entrepreneur who started his career as a nature documentarian and filmmaker. Concerned about global warming, Ross turned his attention to sustainability. As road transport is one of the largest carbon emissions contributors, he decided to create an event to gather emerging new mobility solutions dedicated to lowering emissions and congestion. Autonomy, launched in Paris in 2015, was the result. Ross chose Paris for its central location, strong transport sector, and anti-emissions policies. Autonomy, now the largest urban mobility event in the world, hosts 200 exhibitors, 10,000 visitors, and 100 cities, all dedicated to change the way we move in cities. Ross also advises major companies such as Nike, AXA, Toyota Motor Corporation on mobility disruption. Ross is a sought-after public speaker and has spoken at events all over the world, including VivaTech, ICLEI, World Congress EcoMotion, ITF Summit, and the Polis Network Annual Conference. Ross has written numerous columns on urban mobility, which have been featured in publications like Le Monde, L'Echo, if I'm pronouncing that right, La Tribune, and often quoted in the Financial Times. So, welcome, Ross. I probably don't even have the most recent bio, so you can correct me and add
That's quite
whatever
all.
you
That's all good. All good.
want. Okay, we're just going to
Yeah.
jump in and get started, and we'll talk about the Global Decarbonization Expo as we go. But
Okay. Thanks,
let's
Scott.
kick it off with the first question or topic is, what are some of the latest trends in decarbonization of the transport sector, which re have really inspired you over the last, let's say, 12 months?
I think for me that the two big trends we're seeing is one is obviously electrification, and the other would be autonomous vehicles. So on the first electrification, personal mobility or motor cars or EVs get a lot of the press, but the real big movement is actually happening on the logistics and on the delivery side. So with the Global Decarbonization Expo, we have a summit running alongside that in partnership with La Poste Group, which are now the biggest electric vehicle fleet owners in Europe. And I was speaking to their head of sustainability, Claire Barry-Toe, the other day, and she said to me that the total cost of ownership of the EV fleet is way lower than they anticipated. So, consumers are moving slower than people hoped or anticipated with the purchasing of electric vehicles. But what we're starting to see with logistics deliveries, they're going to move a lot faster just because the total cost of ownership is so much lower than combustion. So that's obviously the first. And then the second, obviously, that we've been talking about autonomous vehicles for a long time, but now they are starting to scale. And I was in China last month, and in Shenzhen for a couple of weeks, and on a busy street you see within a sort of 10, 15-minute period you see 20, 30 or robo taxis moving past you, delivery robots. So they really are here on scale. Yeah.
Interesting. So, yeah, the first topic around kind of, let's say, electrification, then we'll get to autonomy in a second. Electrification, certainly in the commercial deliveries logistics sector, yeah, at scale, absolutely. Slower uptick on the passenger side, obviously, with the recent announcement from Ford Motor Company and divestment in Europe. That was a little bit of a troubling news. I think that just made the headlines yesterday and some other trends, obviously, with a bit of the trade topics on the horizon between EU China, between EU US, China US, it's everywhere basically. So that is something that we're always tracking as well. But certainly in the commercial side, I think those points are spot on. And then on the autonomy side, it's very encouraging to hear that that's being adopted at scale on the robo-taxi side. Obviously, kind of with Waymo and with the Cruise in the San Francisco Bay Area, there's been a bit of a vacillation back and forth. New permits are being issued throughout the state of California and even Los Angeles with Waymo. But again, it's not ex at scale yet. I heard the last recent passenger ride for robo-taxi in San Francisco yesterday, the day before I was reviewing the Blue Sky and Twitter account of Jarrett Walker, the kind of transport consultant from the US. And he said he rode a Waymo for $1. So massively subsidized. And, they're going to have to work out their business model around that. So just another point of kind of discovery or curiosity that we'll see how that, kind of expands in the future. But the next topic I'd like to talk about is where you're based in Paris. So let's talk about Paris and how has Paris emerged as a leader in shared and active mobility beyond the Olympics, beyond Carlos Moreno, beyond Anne Hidalgo, beyond the 15-minute city, beyond all the cliche and everything we've been hearing about the last 24 months. Really, just some very interesting use cases that maybe our audience is not aware of, beyond kind of the mainstream US, UK, 24-hour news cycle, where we hear about Paris all the time. We'd like to hear from, the ground level of where you're based. What's interesting going on that we haven't heard about?
I mean, I think the first thing is that the city, starting a few years ago now, put in 150 million of bicycle lanes, and you really see the results of that now. Today is snowing. I just went out for lunch, and there's bicycle traffic. So always what the big concern was that cyclists were sort of fair weather cyclists, but what you see in Paris is you see huge amount of bike traffic, throughout the day and the evening, irrespective of the weather. So it's really looking a lot more like Amsterdam, and that's thanks to about $150 million of cycle lane infrastructure. That's probably the single biggest change you see in Paris in the last 10 years. It's just the quantity of bicycles on the streets compared to that before. And like I said, it's largely driven by very, very good cycling infrastructure. Apart from that, there hasn't been much change. Rather disappointingly, car share companies have closed. There's no more car sharing in Paris. The Renault car sharing company, Zity, was the last to leave. And they all left voluntarily just because it's an impossibly difficult business to run in Paris. And I don't think there's even any companies looking at doing car sharing or wanting to, that it doesn't exist. The car sharing's had a difficult time in Paris just because of lots of vandalism, expensive city to operate, and not the demand. Then obviously scooters have been banned, so there's no scooter sharing in Paris, or scooter sharing has been banned as opposed, or that they didn't get the tender didn't get renewed, so there's no more scooter sharing in Paris. But you still see bike sharing. There's the usual operators, but much less so than before. What the real single visual change that you see is large number of bike ownership, so just a lot of bikes driven by people that own them as opposed to on the sharing platforms. So I would say that's the only real big change you see in Paris, and obviously a lot more walking too. And that the city has done lots of good work in blocking roads outside schools from cars, opening up the sidewalks, making them bigger, the pavements bigger, and effectively what they do is they take that space away from what were parking bays. So Paris is becoming more and more difficult for motorists, and better for people that are walking and cycling.
So I would argue, as an urban planner or urbanist, then Paris is kind of building upon its Baron von Haussmannian kind of centralist top-down urban planning paradigm of using kind of centralized financing and funding to stimulate kind of demand-side economics, to quote John Maynard Keynes, a government stimulus to basically build out a new public infrastructure type that will induce behavioral change and demand. In this case, one of the key beneficiaries are owners of active modes, owners of active mobility in terms of bicyclists. So the shared schemes, whether they be public or private, haven't really taken off as much as we'd like to see, but there has been a strong modal shift towards cycling, given this kind of stimulus or this shift from the government sector to kind of build out an alternative, let's say, modality. And I think that I'm not saying that this could not be replicated from Paris to other cities, but having kind of a strong centralist government and a tradition of very centralized top-down urban planning, as we saw in Paris in the mid-19th century, I think it's just a continuation of that. It's only logical that this is where what we've seen as a shift over the last decade. I don't know if you would agree or disagree, but that's my personal take on it as an urban planner.
Yeah, look, I think you're saying it in a sort of rather an academic way, but what you have in Paris is you have a strong mayor in Hidalgo who and a strong Green Party. The Green Party always are the head of transport in Paris. So you've got David Belliard, and for a guy called Christophe Najofsky. So they've always been very much anti-motor cars and pro-walking and cycling or active mobility. And they've just changed the landscape sufficiently that they're making more difficult for motor cars because there's less parking and more easy for walking and cycling. I think the challenge is that that's good for Parisians, but it's not really good for industry. And I think that's where, Paris is or the French economy is not stuck, but there's a bit of a lost opportunity or missed opportunity. When this whole sort of new mobility revolution started 10 years ago, and I started 10 years ago, there was this, belief that Europe was leading in the legislation, leading in the thinking. America is obviously very car-centric and kind of stuck behind, and that would translate into new industries and new businesses, but there are very few new businesses coming out of it, and that's unfortunate. And it's very difficult because in Paris you either walk, cycle, or take public transport, as I do. I spend on my bicycle maybe $50 a year, and on public transport maybe 100 euros a year, if that. On walking, zero. So it's hard. How do you build that change in mode into new industries? It's really hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a good point. Okay, so moving on to the next question or comment is around the Global Decarbonization Expo. So tell us about the 2025 event and program and what is in store on the agenda.
Great. So we decided to pivot away from personal mobility, which we've been doing for 8 years. We enjoyed it. It was interesting, but there was a lot of consolidation in that space. And I think, particularly European cities kind of moved in this direction of more walking and cycling, which is obviously good for the environment. And we felt there wasn't, a lot more to do in that space. So my interest has always been decarbonization. Like you said in the beginning, I used to make wildlife films. I've seen habitats, become compromised by increased carbon emissions and increased warming. And I wanted to get really much more involved in an event that could connect the solutions of decarbonization with the companies that are wanting and needing to decarbonize. So we focus on six verticals: decarbonizing depots and distributions. That's logistics companies. That's why La Poste Group is one of our partners, and they obviously don't just do post, but they also do parcel deliveries through some of the companies like DPD. Decarbonizing the grid, decarbonizing rail, decarbonizing public transport, airports and aviation, and finally data centers. So we focused to start on those six verticals. Obviously, there are lots of different industries you need to decarbonize, agriculture, et cetera, but our focus is more this idea of moving people and goods. And obviously, data centers are hugely important and massive new consumers of energy as we move across to more and more AI solutions, which take roughly ChatGPT takes about 12 times as much energy for a request as does a Google search. So, huge amounts more energy requirements. So yeah, that's our focus. In terms of the solutions, we focus on, so those are the industries we wanted to focus on decarbonizing. And the solutions that we're looking at to connect with those buyers are mainly solar, battery storage, electric, and autonomous vehicles. And we believe that those four technologies, solar, battery storage, electric, and autonomous vehicles, are coming together extremely quickly. And actually, the leader of that is Shenzhen in China. About 70 odd percent of their vehicles are electric now. They have a huge amount of battery storage, solar, and you can really start seeing when those four technologies connect, how much more efficient it is. The nice thing about autonomous vehicles is that you use the right size robot to deliver a parcel as opposed to a big van to deliver a parcel if it needs that. And in Shenzhen, I was taken around by an American venture capitalist who ordered the cappuccino that was delivered by a drone, as opposed to a guy on a scooter. Cost him 6 US cents for the delivery, and obviously uses a fraction of the energy of an electric scooter. So because of that, we've now started an office in Shenzhen. We have an office in Shenzhen with some partners there. And we really believe that China has a lot to show and share with Europe, and Europe has a lot to benefit from the speed and scale that China's moving, and the quality of their products, particularly with the battery storage, which is now the next big wave of technology coming in.
So that kind of begs the question in terms of what direction, I guess, geopolitically we're headed in terms of kind of trade and exchange and, let's say also what types of signals we're going to be getting from the EU and Brussels, as well as how individual, governments as well as kind of stakeholders start to, collaborating across these different types of value propositions in the decarbonization space. It's kind of a disruptive market right now. Certainly, it was a wise move, I believe, for your organization to kind of diversify and focus on this broader kind of domain. But it'll be interesting to see in terms of kind of the market size and the demand of how China, let's say, integrates with European stakeholders is certainly a huge positive step. But yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, and as we move into 2025, it'll be interesting to see what kind of traction we make, especially across the value chain. Whereas certain forms of mobility, battery storage, data centers, others, certain domains might move a bit quicker than others, but I guess it's yet to be seen, right? We don't quite know yet.
Yeah, look, I mean, what I think is obviously the big story, which is a very sad story, is the Northvolt going into bankruptcy.
Yeah.
So that's a 15 billion investment, and according to the Financial Times, they will go bankrupt this week or next. And I think that will probably be the last ambitious battery factory project in Europe, just because no one's going to have the appetite to invest after the failure of something that big. And obviously, there's a lot of loss in there, including the European Investment Bank, that's going down at least a billion on that. So I read, just recently in the Financial Times that Europe is thinking of doing deals with Chinese battery producers mainly to set up factories in Europe to do skills transfer, like China did to Europe in the 80s. I think Europeans realize they don't have the experience and the skills to make gigafactories like the Chinese do, and they now need to learn from the Chinese. What our office set up in Shenzhen is wanting to do is to help Chinese and European companies connect to have a knowledge transfer. When I speak to my business partner there, and when I was just there for 2 weeks now speaking to Chinese companies, they are desperate to find new markets now that America's closed with Trump. And they're happy to do, deals where there's ownership sharing, knowledge sharing, set up factories. And I think if Western Europe doesn't start partnering with Chinese companies soon, then they'll just go via Hungary, as they already are. BYD setting up a
Right.
factory in Hungary,
I was just going to
as
mention
is
that.
CATL using a production line made by a company called Hans Laser, but it's one of the leading companies of production lines. So I think this is the tipping point where Europe is stuck in it between a kind of rock and a hard place. Trump is going to put tariffs against Europe. Europe can't compete on software against America, can't compete on hardware against China, and Europe just doesn't have the ability to manufacture what we need for the energy transition. And in order to do that, it has to partner with China. As
Yeah,
unfortunate as it is, that's the
partner.
reality.
Yeah. It's yet to be seen what direction, as you mentioned, Western Europe will go. You mentioned Hungary, yes. I think even Serbia, they've inked deals recently with China. But yeah, 2025 will be the year that more will unfold. So to be politically correct here, let's see how it goes. All right. So the next topic I'd like to kind of chat with you about is, back to Paris, or back to kind of Carlos Moreno, around the topic of the 15-minute city. So, in your personal view, how can cities across the globe implement the 15-minute city at scale? Maybe using kind of the Parisian models, some of the work that has been done at the Sorbonne University and others, and maybe what you've witnessed even recently in China.
Yeah, look, I think the 15-minute city works extremely well in Paris. I'm not too sure if it would work in every city, just because Paris is the densest city in the Western world. I think the average apartment size is 37 square meters. Whereas, many cities, Sydney, Johannesburg, even London are, kind of sprawling cities with suburbs and villages connected together, and then, one kind of CBD, which is bit for business and not for living. So the 15-minute city, I don't think is for everybody, just because it works extremely well. Milan, Paris, there's, Western European or Eastern European cities where you have this very livable city center. But Dallas, America, is not going to work. You have a CBD, and then you have suburbs stretched out. So while it's a great solution for Paris, it's not a great solution for, cities in South America, South Africa, or most other places in the world. It's very much a European solution. So I don't think it's something that you can cut and paste everywhere in the world. The average commute time in America, correct me if I'm wrong, I think is something like an hour. And it's
Yes.
highly unlikely that people are going to be working and living and schooling within a 15-minute walk. So it's not going to happen in suburban type cities. So, the real challenge is, how do you move people cost effectively and with low carbon? And one of the ways to do that is obviously electric vehicles. But if you can get away from vehicle ownership, then you can really reduce the carbon footprint. And then you start going into obviously public transport. It gets much more difficult as you stretch out. And then obviously autonomous vehicles can play a huge role. So I'm really excited as somebody concerned about the environment, about autonomous vehicles. I think particularly autonomous shuttles can fill a gap between what a traditional bus was doing and what private car ownership is doing, in terms of convenience with a fraction of the carbon footprint.
Your comments about kind of the logical adoption of the 15-minute cities makes perfect sense. Probably the least relevance, as you'd mentioned, would be North America, US, Canada, Australia, I would say. Those three countries would probably be the least relevant for at scale adoption of the 15-minute city just due to land use urbanization in the 20th century. It makes hardly any sense at all, other than specific neighborhood centric type of developments with kind of mid density, et cetera. And to again get a bit academic here, which I like to do, it's interesting because Latin America has some very interesting opportunities for the 15-minute city based upon the laws of the Indies. So based upon Spanish colonial development in the 1500s, so which was based on Greco-Roman town and urban planning concepts. So when the conquistadors kind of conquered, Peru, Mexico, all of the, Central South American continent, a lot of the original colonial settlements were quite walkable, with a plaza or built on the Roman agora, in ancient times. And they lend themselves quite well to kind of this 15-minute city concept of which Carlos Moreno speaks about. So if you look at like Cartagena, Colombia, if you look at Lima, Peru, even Buenos Aires, I would consider those to be a bit more amenable to that 15-minute concept. So I like to try to segregate in the Americas, North America's one kind of template, and Central South America are completely separate. And not to say there are better or worse than the European examples that you shared with us, but they are opportunity areas for these types of interventions, or building upon this kind of historical and cultural, fabric that was built upon, over the last 5 centuries. So just some thoughts on my end for that point there.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah.
Yeah. So I just don't think enough of us, not you, but myself and others, give enough credit to the Global South and some very interesting models of urbanism south of the equator, because there's really, really interesting stuff going on and some very great opportunities.
Yeah, and you've got some big cities. I mean, Bogota's 8 million. Yeah, you've got some big cities there too. Yeah.
Absolutely. And then the final point here is tell us about your professional journey from filmmaker to decarbonization influencer.
So I used to make documentaries. We made some from National Geographic. There were sort of nature documentaries, which were very fashionable at the time. And then when I was re really involved in the middle of it, when was that? Probably in the 90s, Big Brother came along, which was the start of reality TV, and suddenly all the budgets for documentary filmmaking dried up very quickly. And then I got involved in the art world. I started working with a very successful South African artist called William Kentridge, and I produced a live event with his animations with live music, and we did that in Central Park, New York, and then in Prospect Park in Brooklyn, and the Guggenheim in Berlin. I kind of toured around, so I started understanding events. And in South Africa, I owned an art fair and a design fair and some different sort of consumer shows. But my real interest was global warming. I was reading at the time, every sort of book that got published about global warming, the first one being Heat by George Monbiot, the Guardian writer. And I could see that this was going to become a big issue just because, carbon emissions were keeping on rising, and there's no way other than warming. So I wanted to be involved in that space. I incorrectly thought that people would change behavior quite quickly just because, global warming is existential threat. If you keep on heating the planet, there's not going to be much of a place to live. So I moved to Paris after the Paris Climate Agreement, which is 10 years ago tomorrow. And one of the reasons I changed to global decarbonization expo, that next year, the 10th anniversary of the Paris Climate Agreement, and I wanted the global decarbonization expo to coincide with that. And in those 10 years, we've had, lots of failures and some successes. I mean, the big failure is that 2024, this year, will probably be the first year on record to have reached 1.5 degree of warming since the Paris Climate Agreement, which was trying to stop warming at 1.5 degrees. So clearly, we are going straight through the 1.5 degree barrier, and at the moment, looking probably by the end of the century more like 3 degrees, which is substantial. Yeah, that's I chose to try and do an event that brought people together that could connect buyers and sellers of solutions because I understood events. I'm not sure if it's the best point of entry into the kind of decarbonization space, but I just don't have the skills to build a battery factory or an EV factory. I understand media, I understand connecting people, so that's what I've been doing, and now I'm really trying to help connect Chinese companies with European companies, because I honestly believe that, and it's not just my opinion, but the Environmental Energy Agency based in Paris says the same thing. If Europe wants to decarbonize, it has to do it with the help of China, just because China has all that hardware. And it's not just solar and PV. China's building 42 nuclear power plants are in production. They are partnered in the one in the UK at the moment, Hinkley. By comparison, France, which is the European leader of nuclear power stations, is only building one. China's able to do stuff at extreme speed and scale. And if you want to decarbonize, that is what you have to do. A nuclear power station in China, $6 billion, you get a nuclear power plant. In Europe, they're like $30 billion. Battery factories. I just wrote in my newsletter this morning about why they sort of call it the European battery paradox, why it's almost impossibly difficult for a European battery factory to exist. You just don't have the ability to produce batteries with the same yield as a Chinese. So Chinese battery factories have a 98, 99% yield, which means they only have to recycle 1 or 2% of batteries that are no good. Europeans start off at a 50% yield. The cost of energy is 2.5 times the price. The cost of labor is 3 times the price. So I think what really needs to happen is that European companies need to work with Chinese companies to bring down the cost of energy, which you can do with solar and battery storage, bring down the cost of industry, which you can do with automatics and robots and autonomous vehicles. And Europe needs to reindustrialize with a clean grid, with clean technology, and a lot of that hardware will come from China, and Europe needs to stop thinking that they can catch up with government money, taxpayers' money, because that money just gets lost. I know it's a rather contrarian view, but yeah.
I agree. Europe
Okay.
does need to reindustrialize, absolutely. And it cannot become isolationist either. I think those are two main points in it. And like you mentioned, it needs to look east. It really does. And that's
Yeah,
the
Trump is going to shut the door. I mean,
so it needs
that's
to look
clear.
east. That's my point.
Yeah,
So yeah, so it has to look east. It
and
cannot
nothing.
be isolationist. And it has to reindustrialize. It had a great industrial past, certainly with Germany and other France, other places, and it needs to kind of find its way and try to leverage the best of global partnerships, certainly with China, but even maybe with other opportunity zones throughout the world, and kind of work to its strength. So I think that that's a great point you make. But of course, it leaves much to be said about kind of geopolitics and what's happening in the United States right now. And Yeah,
And
that
look, I mean,
will only
you know.
accelerate the process, of course. So
Yeah, and
I'm
I think, you know, I
in.
think with Trump going back to oil and gas, there's an opportunity for Europe to kind of steal a march and bring in clean, renewable energy at a lower cost. I mean, there's no cheaper energy than solar. And the big problem with solar was obviously it's intermittent, and what do you do with the energy when you've got too much of it? And now the price of battery energy storage is just crashing. You know, it's now at 100, about $150 a kilowatt hour, you know, pack. It's going to go to, you know, half that in the next 2, 3 years. So suddenly storing energy is going to become so cheap. And when I was visiting battery factories in Shenzhen, I visited one called Xinyang, and I spoke to the guy and I said, you know, who are you selling your batteries to? And he said, I'm selling a lot to Austrian farmers. And I was like, what? He said, yeah, to dairy farmers. And I said, why? He said, well, dairy requires a lot of chilling, a lot of energy, and they're using our batteries to store energy from the grid when it's cheap. And then when, you know, it's expensive, they use the battery storage instead of the grid. And that energy arbitrage, or peak shaving, as they call it, they're paying back the cost of the batteries in 5 years, and the batteries last 20 to 25 years. So there's, you know, a good economic case. And I think we'll only get a transition to clean technology when there's an economic case for it, just because businesses have to be competitive. And if the dirty technology is cleaner, then it's harder for them to switch. But we're now at an inflection point where that is no longer the case. And the clean technology is much cheaper than the dirty technology.
Absolutely. Well, let's kind of focus on where we can find you at. So let's say the Global Decarbonization Expo, where can we find you on social media and kind of some other activities throughout the kind of marketing space where our subscribers can connect with you.
Okay. So I write a newsletter once a week, autonomy newsletter. So if you go to autonomy.paris or Global Decarbonization Expo, you can subscribe to the newsletter, but I write a weekly thought piece. And then our expo is in March in Paris. If you're into autonomous vehicles, we have a summit on autonomous vehicles on the 12th of July in London, which is now the third edition. So that's very much focused on moving people and goods with autonomous vehicles. And we're doing that in partnership with Lucas Neckermann, who I'm sure you are friends with. So that will be interesting. Otherwise, on LinkedIn, I don't, I'm not active on Twitter or X or Blue Sky, anything else. That's,
Maybe Blue Sky. You might want to consider joining.
yeah, I
I
might.
just joined it last week. I'm like, oh, maybe
I
you'll
see
get a lot of
that.
followers.
Yeah, I see that. What, 60,000?
It's
60,000 people a
crazy.
day have left X since the election or something I read on.
I think I've lost as many people on X as I've gained on Blue Sky right now. So it's been insane.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll jump into take a look at
Yeah,
that now.
maybe people find you there. Great. Well, thank you so much, Ross. It's been a
Thanks so
pleasure.
much,
It's
Scott. Yeah.
an honor to. For the City's First Podcast to be a media partner with Autonomy Global Decarbonization Expo. I should probably say that instead. My apologies. Much success to you and the events and kind of this diversification of the value chain. Your insights to partnering with China and looking east and kind of these opportunities on the horizon in bringing clean technologies to scale, as well as kind of thinking through this kind of disruptive landscape and learning from, let's say, past mistakes or other areas that perhaps weren't best adopted, and finding new opportunities where we can really kind of collaborate together in areas that are really kind of improving our public spaces as well as our kind of built environment. So, with that, really appreciate you joining us, Ross. Hope to have you again soon. Probably see you in Paris at the next event. Yeah, it's been a real honor to have you.
Super, Scott. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.